It's been sort of a bittersweet joke for Swamiji. By now, he's rewritten it three times, and it's out of the labyrinth, but it was Crises in Modern Thought for many years of Ananda. And from time to time, Swamiji would just ask people who were close, people who were new, if they had read that book. And of course, almost no one had read the book, because most devotees did not find it interesting. And it was just not well known. If you had read Crises in Modern Thought, it was like the way into Swamiji's heart. It was just made him so happy to know that somebody had read it, because he worked 16 years on that book. I mean, he spent such a long time writing that book. 16 years. Where did I get that number? No, yeah, he didn't. He finished it in 1972, so no, he spent 10 years on it. But he rewrote it and rewrote it. He wrote it, you know, he spent 40 years on it by the time he finally finished it. But Terry McGilloway made an interesting comment at a panel we were having about on Swami's birthday this last time up at Ananda Village. Terry's one of the colony leaders in Seattle, a very insightful man. And he said that everything that Swamiji's done has really been based on Crises in Modern Thought. And Swami himself concurred, and I was thinking about that while I was reading through here, because, see, here's what happened. Swamiji's in SRF. He goes in and he's a monk. Now, you're a monk living with other monks. You have a very consistent reality. It's the great danger of that kind of life, and that's really what has sunk Dhyamata to a large extent, is the complete lack of objective input. And it's so easy in that environment to just lose touch, and then the greater temptation is to become somewhat disdainful of ordinary people's realities. That certainly was what Tara fell into, and that really has been a lot of the bane of SRF, is that they just lost touch with what normal people think. And Swamiji was more or less in that mode. I mean, he was even in India, and he had hoped to make his life in India. He wasn't even going to deal with the West at all. He's never had that much of an affinity for America. He didn't grow up here, and he didn't like it much when he was forced to come here. And even his disdain for America, as you recall, caused him not to buy the autobiography when he first saw it, because it was dedicated to an American saint. That was enough for him to put it back on the shelf. How could there be a saint in America? I mean, it just gives you a clue about how Swami thinks. And he talked about when he was going to have to leave India. I don't know whether it was the trip when he came back in the middle of his time in India, or when it was when he came back at the end. But he was going to have to come back, and he just could hardly bear the thought of coming back to this culture. And then he said an American girl from California came to see him, or he met her, and she personified everything that was good about Americans: the innocence, the enthusiasm, the generosity of spirit, the openness of accepting everyone. And he felt like it was God's gift saying to him that there are devotees everywhere, it's okay. But so Swamiji describes, you know, he describes Master sort of like giving him a clue before the blow fell, which was implanting in him this thought: I could write a book. I could write a book about this subject, which is a very important subject. And probably the thought without ego had come to Swami: who else could write a book like this? Because there was nobody else in SRF who could write on the level that he could. And there was just a handful of disciples of Master. Master himself was gone. He wasn't going to write it. And Swamiji could see this all-pervasive sickness that had set in, that is still rampant, you know, just even worse now. And the thought came to him, well, I could answer this. I have something to say. But, you know, the back of his mind was, how will I ever have the time, and who would ever publish it? And then he describes, and he spends a lot of time really telling us how very difficult it was for him to pay enough attention to those ridiculous arguments to really be able to answer them in a way that didn't just mock them. It's very hard to do, to move out of your own reality sufficiently to really feel somebody else's reality. And the reason that I say everything he's done has been based on that, because that really is one of the things that makes him, that distinguishes him. And sometimes, you know, for many of us who are devotees, we would grow tired of how much energy he'd often put out in public talks to help people who weren't devotees. We just wanted him to be more with us. And over the years, he sort of divided his time a little bit between the two realities. But then he traces through, even just so that anybody reading this book can just at least hear what those basic principles are. When we went through Hope for a Better World, where Swamiji took on all of those thinkers, it's like Hope for the Better World was the next volume of Crises in Modern Thought. And most of us are so into this world that we don't remember anymore how many people are struggling with that one. But Swamiji is sowing seeds for the ages. I was in a, this is a secondary, but we're part of a, well, we attend the meetings, which are very small, informal gatherings of the Palo Alto Ministers Association, just to kind of keep in touch with a greater world than this one, because we are so self-enclosed here. And the last meeting we attended, the subject matter was young people, and the specific issue was the rise in suicide among high school people. Apparently, two Palo Alto high school boys committed suicide either in the last year or the last 2 years. You know, just really tough. And one boy in one of the Jewish congregations, you know, killed himself. Just terrible. You know, 13, 14-year-old kids. So there was this whole discussion of from psychologists and clergy people at this minister's meeting about this whole phenomenon, and everybody's has all these ideas about how what we should do and how we should deal with it. But very few people have stood far enough back from it the way Swamiji has to really understand why these children have such a sense of despair. And it has to do with things like what he's answering in Crises in Modern Thought. There's just this all-pervasive idea that has been foisted upon us by these so-called thinkers that there's no purpose in what we're doing. That what is the point? You know, just to grow up and have a good job and get rich and live like my parents just doesn't really, like, inspire young people very much. And in a perverse sort of way, I think we've added to it by talking to them so much about the nearly insoluble ecological and social and political problems. I mean, has it been such a good idea to get them so worried about the planet? And on one hand, we think it's going to make them responsible, but on the other hand, you know, the children say things like, you know, it's up to me to save the planet. I can't save a planet. And they begin to get quite nervous about it. And a lot of what you see in the really incomprehensible behavior of young people is because of this, because faith has just completely been taken away from them. And we're watching the consequences of our own actions, and we don't recognize it as such. And Ananda and the teachings of self-realization and Out of the Labyrinth for people who want to believe but can't, and Hope for a Better World, and God is for Everyone. These are really fundamental revolutionary contributions to reversing this trend. Swamiji was discussing some particularly unsavory aspect of culture that he's been trying to resist. And he says, you know, he said, I'm trying to save this culture. I'm not trying to pull it down. Just a simple comment. I'm trying to save this culture. And it's just interesting to sort of think on that level. Well, Master was the avatar for Dwapara Yuga, and Swamiji has been his primary spokesman, so it's not a presumptuous comment. It's not based on himself, it's based on what Master wants him to do. And Crises in Modern Thought and the power that Swami, the importance that Swami's put into it and the way it came into Swami's life and how, like, it became the cornerstone of turning his energy back, was Master really saying, I want you to go into the world and bring them this message of hope. That's why I say it's the foundation of everything that he's done. Master's instruction to him, even before he was put out on his own, was, I want you to go where people are suffering and bring them this message. It wasn't, you can stay in India and just be a hermit or anything like that. It was, no, this is where you have to go. And this is the interesting balance point that Ananda's always been walking, which is, on one hand, we're self-realizationists wanting to withdraw into a supportive atmosphere, but on the other hand, we're soldiers making a beachhead for a revolution, and therefore we have to be on the beach. We can't just sort of stay in the boat. We have to get all the way in there, and that's the example Swami's just setting with this. Well, let's take a couple of minutes break. Pardon me? Yes, I wasn't going to talk more about that, though, but I said the reason it's all so vivid in my mind is I've been working on it. But I had something else to say that I don't... Well, it was in the middle of something, and I said, wait, let's just start the camera. Can anyone remember? What were we talking about? Well, even though he was understated, he wasn't understated in himself at all. He wasn't even slightly understated in himself. He was very, very attuned to what was going on, and he was very conscious of the magnetism of things. It's just, I mean, that's, he's always worked with magnetism. He's developed magnetism in people, and he's done everything to develop magnetism. I was just sort of looking at what the chapters here, you know, I Write Music is one of these chapters, this whole cycle of his life that started with music. All of these things are so integral to the story of Ananda, and that's why he put that chapter in, not merely that he's telling the history of his life, I Write Music, because one of the reasons Ananda is successful is because of the music, because we all sing the same music. And you can go anywhere around the world and we're all singing the same music. And he's finding that the people in India are just loving this music. And this is, and it means a lot to him because he knows that the music is what holds Ananda together. It helps, it keeps us harmonious, and it makes us unified in our consciousness no matter where we are. Much more, I mean, Kriya, of course, but the music also. Because it's an actual direct experience of consciousness that we're sharing continuously. And people who don't speak the same language yet know the songs. Or they'll even if you're singing in a different language, you know the melody and you know what it's about. In India, they, in the last 10 years, when Swami was there in the 50s, they just didn't hear Western music, and they couldn't understand Western music. The Indian style of singing is so different, and they don't have harmony. It's just different. He said harmony to them is to sing an octave. They just didn't understand chords. But in the intervening decades, especially in the last 10 years or so, just Western music has completely invaded India. So they're just very accustomed to Western music, except they hear horrible Western music. But they know how to hear it. So now they're hearing, it's just so magnificent to think about what it would be like to just be hearing these songs for the first time. The words, the melodies, the vibrations of them. But what Master gave Swamiji or awakened him to the potential of all this music was just another sort of piece of the puzzle. You know, dive into this understanding of what is afflicting modern society so you can reach the world with my message. That's what Master was saying to him. I have an answer to what is afflicting them, and I want you. And Swami says all of 1964 he spent researching the book and how he had to discipline himself to read those preposterous teachings with an open mind and not a dismissive mind, and not write about them rudely, but write about them with enough respect so that he could really give an argument to somebody else. And then Master gave him this music, this whole new way. And Swamiji is he's very cautious about these things. He actually, he remarked that Master also wrote popular music. Like he used to sing the Battle Hymn of the Republic, remember? And he changed a few words and he put words to that classical piece. Remind me, Joe, the one.
Well, it's Divine Love Sorrows.
Divine Love Sorrows. Yes. And can you just do a verse, just a line of... That beautiful song? Yeah. That was the melody, was a well-known classical piece, and Master wrote words for it. And there was one other song, it seems to me, that Master... Yes, right, exactly. And so Swamiji said, well, Master did this too. Master wrote popular kinds of music. And Swamiji felt, well, if Master did it, then it's something that I can also do. Master, of course, didn't do it on the scale that Swami did. It's not that everything that Swami does, Master had to have done, but it did reassure him to sort of see that it was there. And now it's played this enormous role, not the least of which is it's given so many other people an opportunity to be artistic in a way that is right, it has a very strong vibration. You know, whereas if we were just had to create our own songs, we wouldn't necessarily have had the power, inward power, to create them at such a level. And so Ananda's a lot. And in the early years of Ananda, these are so much fun. Swamiji was, he wrote the harmonies and he started getting groups singing. And for many years, Swami did not sing solos at all. And he always had the groups sing. And it wasn't until the groups were well established that he went back to singing himself, because he wanted other people to get into it. And he knew that if he didn't give them that opportunity, they never would. He would just always pull himself back in order to make it happen for others. And you wouldn't even know that he was doing it. You would just sort of, that would be the way things were. And it would be only a long time later that you'd begin to realize again that he just wanted others to have the opportunity and wanted their commitment. And but there were these quartets, mostly, or six or eight people singing, and they would sing these songs at Sunday service, in the little Sunday services that we had up there at Ananda Village. And many, many times, Joe, I don't know if you were ever in there or if that was before your time, he would stop them in the middle of a song, correct them, or afterwards he would point out how they hadn't done it right. Oh, and people would get so upset. Oh, how dare he embarrass them, you know. And he just was persistent in it because he wanted them to put out the energy to really get it right. He wasn't going to be content with their just, as he said himself, every single note was deliberate. And I wasn't going to just let them just choose other notes because those notes were not right. It was a language and had to be said exactly right. Plus there was like a, just not enough energy, not enough awareness. And he just kept correcting them and correcting them and correcting them until they began to put out enough energy to begin to get it right. I mean, he still does it sometimes. I don't know whether he... I can't remember whether it was in public or not. Go ahead. I was talking about... switch subjects here, but talking about when we were at the... when Ananda went to the SRF convocation to protest the lawsuit, and we were singing. A lot of SRF members, we sat on one particular day when the SRF members went on a field trip to all the other locations. The convocation is in a downtown hotel, and then they took a field trip to the various centers, Mount Washington and Hollywood Church. And we weren't on their property, we were right at their property. And at Mount Washington especially, it was very quiet. I wasn't with that group, but Christy and... I can't remember, maybe it was Christy, but... anyway, they sat right on the edge, and because it was very quiet there, they could be heard all over the grounds, and many SRF members thought that it was just a wonderful new addition to the field trips, was that there were these people singing Master's chants, you know, just like angels just around out there. And the other wonderful story from singing was the group went to the Hollywood Church, and they were just right there on the sidewalk. You know, we had found out what we could do legally, and so we had our place on the sidewalk. And all afternoon, they stayed there for hours, and these different buses would come, and they were right at the entrance, and so the people had to walk right past them. We were, you know, inches from the people we were trying to communicate with. And they would come, and they would have their little thing, and then we would sing, and then they would get on their bus, and they would go away, and there would be interludes. And, you know, as the day went on, things got looser and looser. And SRF had been so nervous about our coming that they had actually hired a security service. And so there were security guards, and they had been told, the security guards had just been prepared for God knows what. And so there was this sort of, at first they were so tough with us, and then there was this gradual realization that, you know, like, this is not what we expected. And especially at that Hollywood Church that day, the security man was so enjoying what we were doing. He sort of, you know, would start saying, you know, here comes the bus. And once, like toward the end of the day, they were just a little worn out, and the bus was coming, and people were kind of lackadaisical. And he said, they're here, start singing, you know, like this. He was just making it happen for us. It was just wonderful, because the music is, how can you doubt the goodness and sincerity of people who sing like that? And of course, we sing beautifully. You know, it was just, it was really, and all of that was, and that was why we were so joyful doing that. Swamiji had been a little nervous about our doing that because he was afraid we would become angry.